Read and hear more about important news and policy issues at ncpolicywatch.com. This is News and Views.
Welcome back to News and Views. I'm Rob Schofield. In his profound and exhilarating new book, When the Stars Begin to Fall, Overcoming Racism and Renewing the Promise of America, author, scholar, and former U.S. Navy commander Theodore Johnson persuasively argues that racism is both alive and healthy in our country and a profound, even existential threat to our democracy. Happily, however, Johnson doesn't leave it there. Weaving memories of his and his family's multi-generational experiences with racism alongside strands of U.S. history, Johnson makes a persuasive case that we can still find a blueprint for national solidarity in the exceptional citizenship long practiced in Black America. I caught up with Johnson, who recently discussed the book at length in an online NC Policy Watch Crucial Conversation via Zoom earlier this week. Well, Ted Johnson, welcome to News and Views. Thanks so much for being with us.
So happy to be here. Thanks for having me.
So the new book, When the Stars Begin to Fall, Overcoming Racism and Renewing the Promise of America. Give us a little thumbnail sketch of why you decided to write this book and what's sort of the basic message you're trying to convey.
So the basic reason I wrote the book was because I felt like there needed to be a book that spoke about the problems and challenges racism presents the country in a way that still feels patriotic and aspirational and hopeful. And so I didn't want to write a doomsday scenario about how racism was going to doom us all. And I didn't want to write some Pollyanna-ish, you know, very flowery ode to American progress that just sort of footnotes, oh, by the way, racism has been a problem. I wanted to sort of merge the two binaries that we see too much in on bookshelves today to suggest that we can have a patriotic discussion about how we have fallen short as a nation and how racism has been the primary area where those shortfalls have harmed people and still continues to plague us.
That said, you don't soft pedal it. You may make it clear that you think this is an existential threat to the American promise in many important ways that racism is.
That's exactly right. I, you know, with all the hope and optimism that goes into the book and hopefully comes out of it when readers finish, I do not avoid the truth. I tell some hard truths, some ugly truths about our country and our history, and suggest that if we don't address them, that we risk the entire project, the entire democracy, the well-being of not just the nation and its citizens, and we risk proving the idea that we say we were founded on to be nothing more than flowery rhetoric and not something that really guides how we interact with one another or what we want for our country. So I do believe that it's possible for a nation state like the United States to persist, even if racism continues and even worsens, because we have had a nation where racism was extremely bad. But I also say that the idea we were created on, that we're all created equal, that we have these unalienable rights, life, liberty, and pursuit of happiness, that the government derives its power from the consent of the governed, none of those things can coexist with racial inequality. So the choice is now before us on what remains. And if we choose the easy route, we risk proving the idea to be, again, just a superficial proclamation, or we can prove to be the people that made the unattainable actually real, which is to say to create a nation where a multiracial egalitarian society is the thing that exists.
Another point you make is that you characterize it more, that racism more as a crime of the state, not necessarily a crime that's embedded in people's hearts, although I suppose it is embedded in some people's hearts, but that what you're about here is addressing public policy and addressing changes that we can, tangible changes we can really make, rather than trying to get into the deep psychology of every individual.
That's exactly right. There probably is a way to change the hearts and minds of every person in the country to be not racist. That is a long-term project that requires a lot of resources that I don't think exist, frankly. I don't know if humankind is possible to exist without some kind of discrimination. So there's an old public policy maxim that says to be hard on structures and be soft on people. And that's what this book does. It essentially says that racism is something that the state has allowed to perpetuate in our structures, and that the way to get out of this is through public policy. And with good public policy and principled people implementing this policy, then people's hearts and minds will begin to change, because we will create a society where explicit racism and even the sort of the racist byproducts of other endeavors are unacceptable, are shameful. And the acceptable way to belong in society is to be a constructive member of it, which contributes to the dismantling of the effects of racism. So this is a book about how we can craft public policy by bringing people together and making demands on the nation state in order to create a society that's more egalitarian, and also in the long run to change people's hearts and minds and to behave more like the idea of America and less like a selfish American who wants to hoard as much of the country for themselves to the exclusion of others.
Are there examples of those kinds of policies, of those kinds of shifts that you call for us to bring about in this book?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the civil rights movement gives the clearest set of examples. You know, when Lyndon Johnson's Great Society legislation is signed into law, the Civil Rights Act of 64, Voting Rights Act of 65, the Fair Housing Act of 68, these were public policy measures that changed the country over the course of a decade. But it did not change the hearts and minds of every person in the country over the decade. If we remember the presidential election of 1968, there was a third party candidate who ran on the platform of racial segregation, George Wallace. And not only did he run, he won something like four or five states. The last time a third party candidate won electoral college votes was when a segregationist ran on the platform of Black and white people being unequal. So just because we saw those three transformational sets of legislation following, you know, the transformational Brown v. Board Supreme Court ruling in 54, the executive orders desegregating the military and the federal workforce in 48, even after 20 years of progress, we still see a person running for president on the platform of racial segregation and winning states. So hearts and minds didn't change, but 20 years later, no matter what you thought of Ronald Reagan's politics or George Bush's politics in the 80s, the kind of racism that we saw in the 50s and the 40s was no longer socially acceptable. Certainly there were other things that were done to create racial inequality, but that kind of explicit hatred of another group because of the color of their skin was no longer deemed acceptable in polite society. And that was because of public policy, not because there was a campaign to change people's hearts and minds that would hopefully lead to better legislation and better policy writ large.
We're talking with author, scholar, former U.S. Navy commander Theodore Roosevelt Johnson about his new book, When the Stars Begin to Fall, Overcoming Racism and Renewing the Promise of America. One of the points you make in the book, and we talked about this in a conversation that we hosted a while back, Ted, is the question of colorblindness. Mm. The notion that, you know, I myself give lectures or talk sometimes, and I'm confronted often by white people who say, tell me how our state laws aren't already colorblind. Isn't that the objective? And I have friends and acquaintances who are Black. I'm colorblind. Isn't that, you know, once we've achieved that, everything else takes care of itself. And I think you have a pretty compelling response to that.
Yeah, it's a complicated one because it used to be the case that there were people who wanted a colorblind society and then there were racists. And so pick your side. Are you racist or do you think colorblind is the way to go? And of course, good people say a colorblind society is preferable. But when we talk about both policy and our history, colorblind policy doesn't undo the damage that history has done. And so if we want to have a society that is egalitarian, then we have to meet people where they are, which means we have to take into account their different group histories, their different group experiences, different group conditions, which means color conscious approaches are a better fit because now we can take into consideration more elements of the group whose problems we're looking to address and then tailor public policy to those challenges. If we gave everyone the same thing, that might feel good to us. It might be colorblind, but it doesn't actually solve problems among a diverse group of people with a diverse set of problems. The example I've been giving of recent is around education. If you have a poor white community in the hills of Appalachia or the mountains of North Carolina, and a poor Black community in inner city Baltimore, and their school systems of both of these communities are not turning out good students or have poor educational outcomes, to just say we're going to give increased funding for standardized testing prep for both communities will not address the needs of either of those communities. They have different histories, different populations, different skill sets, different troubles, different teachers and school systems and tax structures and all of these things. So you have to take into consideration the location, the people, the community, the experiences, and the history, which means you have to take into account race. The other thing I'll say very quickly is often when people say color conscious approach or race conscious approach, they interpret that to mean quotas for a certain group of people, or that race is the main factor when we think about how to address problems. Color conscious means you're aware that different racial groups may have different histories and different experiences. And that awareness means you tailor your public policy to those communities. It doesn't mean that you have a box of goodies and you determine what's the color of your skin. Okay, you can get goodies. And because you have the wrong color skin, you cannot. So when we pull out from that, we'll see that color conscious approaches that still align to our principles of equality and freedom and liberty and opportunity, then we'll see we're actually closer to promoting and creating the America that we want instead of being further away from it.
I think it would be interesting for our listeners to hear a little bit about your personal history. You grew up in North Carolina. You worked your way through the United States Navy to a high office. You served in Washington, D.C. But tell us a little bit about how, if you don't mind, how that background, how the your upbringing and your career has shaped this view you've developed of this important issue and how it led you to write this book.
Yeah, so it is absolutely a product of both my military service, my upbringing, and my family's history in America. I am the grandchild of sharecroppers. My father's parents were sharecroppers in South Carolina, and my mother's parents were sharecroppers in Southwest Georgia. Both of their parents and my parents grew up in poverty. They grew up in the Jim Crow South, where everything was segregated, where voting was out of the question, where they had to step off the sidewalks when white people were coming in their opposite direction. And they were the first, my parents were the first in their generation to go to college. Both of them went to Shaw University right there in Raleigh, North Carolina, and then spent 30 years each at IBM. So I grew up in the suburbs of Raleigh, predominantly white neighborhood, good schools, staunchly middle class, and then went to off to college and joined the military afterwards in hopes of, one, becoming a man by doing something on my own and not having my parents help me through it. And military had to sort of do it on my own merits, and also make a living and take on a job that would make my parents proud. But it was never lost on me two big things that sort of make the backbone of the book. The first is my grandmother, my grandfather, my mother's parents, who I was able to meet. My father's parents died before I was born, but they never were spiteful or hateful toward the country, despite the fact that they had been denied the very democracy that they'd been promised in the Constitution, despite the fact that they had sent children and grandchildren off to fight in the nation's wars. They were never bitter to the point of despising the nation. They were always hopeful and optimistic that if they continued to work hard and continue to fight for liberty and freedom, that more of it would be available to their children than was available to them. At the same time, I'm also a product of military institutions because I spent 20 years in the Navy. And so I do have a reverence for our sort of quasi-religious civic expressions like the flag and the Statue of Liberty and Pledge of Allegiance and the National Anthem. I don't see those as divisive symbols. I see those as symbols that stand for a set of principles that the nation has not yet lived up to. And so what these things showed me was that there is tremendous struggle in the Black experience in America, both historically and contemporarily. And there is tremendous hope and optimism for what America can become. And there's tremendous beauty in the principles on which America was founded. All of those elements are in this book. Like you said, my name is Theodore Roosevelt Johnson III. I'm a Black guy from North Carolina, named after a rich white New Yorker Republican president from over a century ago. And it's because he invited Booker T. Washington to the White House in 1901. And it was the first time that a Black man had been invited to the White House to dine socially with the first family. And my great grandparents were so moved by this invitation and the dinner, like many other Black Americans throughout the South were moved, that they named their third son after the president, not after Booker T. Washington, who was nationally renowned in the Black community for his work in education, but after the president, almost as if to insist that there's nothing ridiculous about these poor sharecroppers in South Carolina naming their child after a president of the United States because of this gesture of racial equality, even if the president himself may not have meant it to be that symbolic. And so I carry the weight of that story, the weight of my family's narrative, the weight of my family's bad experiences they've had in this country, but I'm also bolstered by their hope and optimism in the nation and in the principles that I've for 20 years put on the uniform to defend. that comes together in a mix that's not really prevalent in a lot of our political conversations and debates today. And so the hope here is that my book adds something new to the conversation and will bring more people on board to create the kind of solidarity we need to address racism.
The author we've just been speaking with is Theodore Roosevelt Johnson III, Ted Johnson. His powerful, eloquent, and ultimately hopeful book is When the Stars Begin to Fall, Overcoming Racism and Renewing the Promise of America. Ted, thanks so much for joining us. We look forward to talking to you again. And we urge all of our listeners to check this book out. They can find it online and all the usual places.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Right.
Thanks again. Take care.
Okay.
Well, that's it for this edition of News and Views. Remember, you can check us out online and subscribe for free to some of our state's best news coverage and political commentary at ncpolicywatch.com. For producer Clayton Henkel, this is Rob Schofield. Thanks for joining us. We'll talk to you again next week.
You've been listening to News and Views. A weekly look at state and policy issues is a production of North Carolina Policy Watch. Visit them online at ncpolicywatch.com.